works. For this first session, we're going to announce them out loud, but in subsequent sessions, they will just appear in the chat briefly. Those passwords will appear in the chat briefly. After the program, you'll log into our website, www.publiccontractinginstitute.com, to enter those passwords. At the end of the year, all those collated passwords will become a certificate that you can turn in for credit. If for some reason, during the year, individual sessions of the program, you need certificates for that, you can go ahead and email someone at PCI and they will get you pointed in the right direction. In addition to that, we invite your questions. During this first session, you just need to raise your hand to ask questions. We'll unmute you and you can ask your question. You may also, at any point in the program, email me or Steve, and we'll answer your questions. My email address is john@publiccontractinginstitute.com. And Steve's is farfun@publiccontractinginstitute.com. So go ahead and send us your questions or raise your hand if you need to answer our question. In addition to that, those passwords we give, once you have all three of them, count them three, you can go ahead and we'll make a trivia question. The first person to raise their hand and first person to email me the answer to their trivia question after the last password is given will win a fabulous prize. So go ahead and email that to me. The first correct answer will win. All right, Steve and Tim, how are you today?
Doing great, Fritz. Thank you for that introduction. Did we lose Steve?
I think we lost Steve. Well, and I don't know where Patrick is. Patrick is muted. And
I'm right here. I'm all good. I'm with you guys.
All right. Well, I can get started for Steve. First of all, welcome to the 2023 edition of Fun with the FAR. Steve conceived this program over 10 years ago. And as it has developed over the years, we've had several thousand people attend this program. And I've been lucky enough to serve as a guest on several occasions, which has always been a lot of fun. We're trying to provide all of you, and this is a mix of government and non-government students on the program today. We're trying to give you an experience that helps you find the FAR approachable. The FAR is one of the most daunting things in government contracting. It's 3 inches thick. It's fine print. I don't think anyone during the Trump administration ever let Mr. Trump know that the FAR existed, because I don't think he would have been real happy about that. But this is a very daunting part of our business. And Steve's goal, our goal, is to make it more approachable, more workable for you. And every other week, you'll meet with Steve and a guest speaker who will talk about different parts of the FAR. They're not going to do PowerPoint slides. It's not going to be death by PowerPoint. We're not going to sit here and just read the FAR verbatim from day to day. It's going to be something that we talk about and give you the general philosophy and the background, the purpose of the different FAR sections. And hopefully you'll find this very rewarding. Now, what are Steve's expectations? Well, first, Steve expects that this is a two-way street. You'll get more out of this course, much more, if you read the assigned reading and outlines before each episode, so that you are prepared to talk, to ask the right questions, to engage with Steve and your fellow audience members during these sessions. And historically, that's been a huge plus to this program. Second, before each episode, if there's something in particular you're worried about, let Steve know about that so he'll be sure to cover it. For example, when you get to FAR Part 42, if some of you are having problems with what we call constructive changes, and they're really making you a worried person, well, then you would ask Steve to cover constructive changes in addition to the changes clause. And he would do that anyway, but this is just an example. Ask questions. You're paying for the program. Get your money's worth. Ask Steve questions. And finally, listen. Steve comes to you with 30 years of experience. His speakers come to you with at least 20 and sometimes up to 50 years of experience in this business. And so these are men and women who have been around the block. It's not their first rodeo, and they can work with you to learn how to work with and understand the FAR. So if as Steve likes to say, I want you to learn how buyers think and how sellers think and the context connected to all their thinking. And that's what this program is going to do. Now, over the next 52 weeks, your participation will be rewarded. Steve awards what we call fun points, F-U-N, fun points, to those of you who participate in the contests. If you ask good questions, answer questions, or sometimes just if Steve is feeling well, feeling good on a particular day, you might get a prize. So those who accumulate the most points in a given month will win a fun prize. Now, what are these prizes? What do they consist of? Fritz called them fabulous prizes before I jumped on. Well, things like a Starbucks gift card, which my wife would kill for. Fun with the Far logoed products. I remember playing golf at a local club up near Baltimore about 2 years ago. And as I was walking over to the putting green, there was a group of about 10 people sitting there having a drink after they played golf. They all had Fun with the Far shirts on. It was hilarious. So that's going to be something you can experience at some point with your Fun with the Far swag. There's also going to be a grand prize for the person, the participant, who's accumulated the most points by the end of the season. Now, just to make sure we're all on the same page, the views and the opinions that Steve or
Hey, Tim, just go ahead and unmute yourself and click the mic button real quick.
Okay.
Perfect. There we go.
All right. Well, Patrick, are you saying no one heard anything I was saying?
No, so that was only about 5 seconds. I think the computer did it automatically or something. So you were good. Everything was great. Just the past 5 seconds.
All right. So the views are, it's not, these are not things that constitute legal advice. You have lawyers for that. Use them. But these, what you are hearing or will be hearing represent the views of people who are very experienced in the business. But as all of you know, every case is different, right? And one little fact can separate your case from another case. So we're not here to give you legal advice. We are here to help you know when to ask the right questions. All right. I think I've covered everything. Let's move into the FAR itself. So FAR is an acronym for Federal Acquisition Regulation. Now, if you're new to this business, you're going to learn now, if you haven't already gotten the idea, that acronyms are part of what we do day in and day out. I probably use others already just in the 5 minutes I've been talking, but we start with the FAR, the acronym for the Federal Acquisition Regulation. And it is the Bible of government contracting. It governs how executive branch agencies purchase goods and services in federal acquisitions. And that phrase, there are a lot of defined terms in our business. And the major definitions that cover our business are all in FAR Part 2. And the word acquisitions is defined in FAR Part 2. Now, the FAR does not cover grants. It does not cover what we call other transactions. And so if your company or your agency has given you responsibility for grants or other transactions, the FAR is not what's going to cover it. And you need to know that. Now, the FAR also does not cover non-executive branch agencies. For example, the Postal Service has its own regulations. The, go ahead. So, the Federal Aviation Administration, even though it's in the executive branch, has its own set of regulations. They were able to carve themselves out. But by and large, if you're doing business with an executive branch agency, that business is covered by the FAR. And when you are talking with contracting officers in federal agencies, if you can show them how your position is consistent with the FAR, basically, you're probably going to prevail in that discussion, whatever you're trying to get them to agree to, because the FAR is their Bible. It was like all federal regulations, the FAR comes from a statute. And the statute was passed in the late 1970s. And as a result of that statute, which is at 41 USC, the FAR was drafted and took effect on, I believe, April 1st, 1984. I understand it was April Fool's Day. Don't, all you cynics out there, I don't want you to jump on that. So it's been around since 1984. And you can find it online. We have you should have the website for that. Patrick, can we move the slides?
Yep.
Keep going. Okay, we're good there. Okay, so the FAR has been around since 1984, and it's published in the Code of Federal Regulations, what we call the CFR, but of course everything is available online right now. And if you go to a website, www.acquisition.gov, you'll be able to find the FAR. My preference, to be honest with you, and I'm always going to be honest with you, is I always had my law firm buy us hard copies of the FAR. It's a soft paperback version, as I'm holding up here, 3 inches thick, as I told you. I think it's updated every 6 months. I'm a dinosaur, right? You can see that. So I'm just more comfortable with being able to thumb through things and make notes and put tabs on them. And my FAR is usually pretty marked up by the end of a 6 month period. I prefer that. Now, I understand, having children of our own who are in the business world, that everybody here works online and you're very comfortable with that. Great. So it's www.acquisition.gov. Now, the first thing you'll notice when you pull out the FAR is that it's divided into different parts. It has subchapters, parts, subparts, sections, subsections, and you will see in working with it that there's a numbering system that they use. And so, for example, if I were to talk about FAR 1.105-2, just as an illustration, so 1.105, the digits to the left of the decimal, that is the one, that's what part of the FAR it's in, FAR part one. The numbers to the right of the decimal, before the dash, are the subparts and the sections. So 1.105, and then we have a dash, and the number to the right of the dash is the subsection. So again, you're going to get a little tired of this during your career. What are we talking about? We're talking about FAR 42.503A1, or we're talking about FAR 31.107B3, right? But you have to get used to that. That's the terminology. FAR Part 1-105-2 explains all this and how the numbering system is arranged. So let's talk about FAR Part 1. First of all, this is where you go for basic policies. This is the whole background of the FAR, if you will, and why it's there. So FAR Part 1 lays out the basic policies and the general information about the FAR. And it tells you what its purpose is, what authority it was written under, when it applies, the numbering systems, the whole nine yards. So it's good background information. And I would say that it's not a bad thing for you to read when you're done with our program today. Just take a look at this if you haven't already. And by the way, you don't usually look at it in the course of your career, because you will be in the operative parts of the FAR, right? You'll be in FAR Part 15 if you're dealing with the negotiated procurement. You'll be in FAR Part 31 if the Defense Contract Audit Agency has disallowed certain costs you incurred under a Navy contract. And so those are the operative parts of the FAR, if you will. FAR Part 1 is background, so you're not likely to go there, but it's not a bad idea to take a look at it to get your arms around what this system encompasses. And FAR Part 1-102 talks about the seven guiding principles of the FAR. Now, let me assure you, and Steve would tell you this as well, if you're in this business for a few years, whether you are on the government side of the table or the contractor side of the table, You might wonder whether it's time to remind people about what the purposes of the FAR are, the seven guiding principles, because in their activities, in what they do, in what they say, they sometimes seem ignorant of them. But let's walk through them. First of all, the FAR is designed to satisfy the end user customer in terms of cost, quality, and schedule. The end user customer. Second, the FAR is designed to maximize the use of commercial items. Now, that's been around for 25 years. It started in the mid-90s. For those of you who are older and come my vintage, when I broke into the business in the early 70s, my gosh, you would have a DOD procurement for trousers, for fatigue trousers for the Army. That might be a 20-page specification, single space, that the contractor had to abide by. And you can imagine most of the regular trouser manufacturers, Hagar and Farron, whoever they wouldn't bother with that. They wouldn't put up with that kind of stuff, right? And so there was this huge debate about how the government was overpaying for things. So that debate finally was heard by Congress in the mid-1990s, and the FAR was rewritten as a result of some major statutory changes, and commercial items became the big kid on the block when it came to federal acquisition. And it was a huge cultural change for our business. And we talk about commercial items when we talk about FAR Part 13 and FAR Part 12 and 13. So we'll get there in several weeks. But trust me when I say that the government is big on buying things that are commercial items or services. Now, having said that, I wouldn't want to lead you to believe that because of those statutory and regulatory changes, the government acts just like a commercial buyer. They do everything the way Ford or GM would buy things in the marketplace. Now, that's not what goes on here. And why not? Because the U.S. government is a sovereign power. Sovereigns have different interests than private citizens and companies do. They're spending the taxpayers, the public dollar. And as a result of that, we have to have rules and regulations that guarantee the integrity of the procurement process. And the FAR was written in part to do that. Okay, what are the other guiding principles of the FAR? Well, the FAR makes a big push, or puts a big push, on using contractors who have a track record of successful past performance. And past performance is different from experience. And Steve will talk about past performance to some degree when we move down the line in our program. But let's say for me, do I have experience taking math classes? Yes, I do. What's your past performance in math classes? Pretty lousy. That's why I married a math major. So I've contracted it out, if you will. So past performance and experience are two very different concepts. And you will see that in the award of negotiated contracts under FAR Part 15, the negotiated contracting system, past performance is a major factor in every acquisition. So your track record matters. Continuing with the guiding principles, the FAR is designed to promote competition. There's a statute from 1982 called the CECA, another acronym, the Competition and Contracting Act. And CECA is designed to maximize competition. And some of you have already heard about bid protests in government contracting, which is one reason some people won't do government contracting, because of bid protests. But most bid protests, not all, but most bid protests are handled by the GAO in Washington, D.C., the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. They are called the Congressional Watchdog. And the GAO is an arm of Congress. It's a congressional agency that is designed to investigate the executive branch to determine, and its contractors, to figure out whether the executive branch is spending the money that's been appropriated properly. And so as a government contractor, you might find yourself under a GAO audit, for example. But it's also famous for handling what we call bid protests, where ABC company wins a $30 million contract and XYZ company challenges a bid protest saying they shouldn't have won that contract. We should have. Now, one of the statutes that comes into play many times in these competitive procurements is the Competition and Contracting Act. And if GAO discovers that the procurement agency did anything that somehow limited competition, that will be a they will uphold the protest, because GAO views itself as the lifeguard, the protector of competition in the federal workplace. So again, you'll get into all these things when Steve covers FAR Part 33 and bid protests, and brings in some very experienced lawyers who do nothing but these bid protests every day. It's a fascinating discussion. But again, the FAR is designed to promote competition. It's designed to, now this might catch some people as something funny, but strike you as something funny. Minimize administrative costs. That's debatable, but it's designed to do that. And it's designed, and when you get to FAR Part 3 in the next session, to conduct business with integrity and fairness, with transparency, with open communication. That's a huge part of the process, the transparency. And remember, just a minute ago, I talked about the integrity of the procurement process. When I practiced law for 45 years, I retired a few years ago, but we pounded on that in making arguments at the GAO or in the courts. If we thought the agencies had acted improperly, we pounded on that concept of the integrity of the procurement process and how important that is. And finally, the FAR's policy, the guiding principles, the final one is fulfilling policy objectives. So, for example, if Congress decides that we want to limit the number of procurements or the amount of foreign.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now, Steve. Can you hear me? All right. So as an example, if Congress decides they want to put a limit on how much we buy of foreign services or products, we call this, among other things, the Buy American Act, the FAR is written to implement those policies. If Congress decides that we want to maximize competition in contracts, as they did in 1982, then the FAR is rewritten to implement those policies. So fulfilling policy objectives is a big part of the FAR. And when statutes are enacted or amended, the FAR will be amended to implement those statutes. So the FAR really is taking the statute that Congress has passed out there and bringing it down to the working level, so that you and I, as government contracting officers, as lawyers working on both sides of the table, we've got this regulation to work with, and it implements these statutory mandates, if you will. So one of the concepts we encounter, and this is one of the things that separates the world of commercial contracting from the world of government contracting, is this concept that you'll see in FAR Part 1 called the acquisition team. Now you'd think, well, who would be on a government agency acquisition team? Well, certainly you have the representatives of the technical, the supply, and the procurement community. So the contracting officer, which is not something that we find in commercial procurement. We have someone called a COR, a contracting officer's representative, or a contracting officer's technical representative, a COTR. Yeah, sure. Those are people who are on the acquisition team, but they have advisors. And those advisors consist of auditors, pricing specialists, quality control folks, lawyers. They are all part of the acquisition team, as would be the end user customer, who's usually represented by that person we call the COR, right? He or she represents the end user. And they have a vested interest, if you're a dog in the fight, in these programs. So they're members of the acquisition team. But surprisingly, contractors are also considered to be part of the acquisition team. Because to do these things correctly, to perform government contracts in a successful way, the contractor has to be part of the team from the get-go. And I remember when I was a contracting officer, we basically viewed and treated our contractors as partners. You had to, or you wouldn't get anywhere. If they're adversaries, you're, from the get-go, limiting your possibilities. Now, I'm not saying you're all in cahoots and you're out going to the bars every night together. No, no, no. But you have to work as business partners. You have different interests to protect, but you are business partners. So what is the...
Hey, Tim, can you hear me now?
I hear you, Steve. Welcome.
Oh, better late than never. I apologize to you all. I've been having some serious technical difficulties here. Once again, the reason why I've got Tim here as my guest is he is the best in the business. Tim, thank you so much for moving on in the outline up to the acquisition team in FAR Part 1. I really do appreciate that.
My pleasure, Steve. I think we're ready for our first password.
All right, great.
All right, so for the passwords, just as a reminder, you want to write these down if you are seeking credit. Make sure you have these down, and you'll be filling them out in a post-session survey. And the first password of the day is Willis, W-I-L-L-I-S. Willis. Thank you.
All right, so Tim, did we just start the acquisition team, or have you got into
a... We talked about who's on it, including the contractors.
Right.
And so we were just about to talk about the role and responsibilities of the acquisition team.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Tim, I, again, appreciate that. The key player from the government's perspective, of course, on the acquisition team is the contracting officer. And that particular contracting official within the executive agency has the sole authority to award, to change, or to terminate the contract. No other government official has the ability to do those three things. Now, one of the things that's always interesting, Tim, is warrant authority. And there's something called warrant authority that applies specifically to contracting officers and to some extent also contracting specialists who might be working with them. A contracting officer, based upon experience and education, is provided by the executive agency authority to take action up to a certain dollar threshold. And that's very, very important. The contracting officer is going to be identified in your contract. And that's also an important thing to note. That provides the contractor with specific notice. That's important. It's a legal term of art. With specific notice as to who the contractor should rely upon for contracting actions. And I'll give my first I Had Fun with the FAR t-shirt to the first person who can tell me where in a solicitation would the name of the contracting officer be identified. And since we can't, we don't have a chat function, if someone wants to raise their hand and Patrick and or John will identify and let you actually talk to us. This will be a first time on Fun with the FAR.
Yes, it will.
All right. So Tim, who else from the government side is on that acquisition team other than the contracting officer?
Well, as you were out in cyberspace, I told the class that we have these people that represent the end user, the COR or the COTR, and those are people that, Steve, you and I have had this discussion. If you ask a government contractor, someone who's working for, who's your customer? Some people will give you the name of the COR. Some people will give you the name of the contracting officer. But the COTR is an important part of the COR, an important part of that team. But the CO, the contracting officer, also has QC people. She's got auditors. She's got lawyers. They're all part of that team.
Yeah, absolutely. And also let's not forget about the program managers.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Again, the end user. Yeah.
Who have overreaching responsibilities And often, Tim, in that hierarchy, the contracting officer might actually be reporting to the program manager.
Well, Steve, as you know, many a contracting officer, if not most, are outranked by their customer, the people on the customer side.
And we now, the interesting thing, Tim, again, I was offline at the beginning when we were talking about the background and the guiding principles in FAR Part 1. I think it's an important fact that FAR Part 1 notes specifically who the ultimate end user customer is. And a lot of people lose sight of that. The ultimate end user customer is the U.S. taxpayer, me and you. And one of the things that folks often forget, that the contracting officer is responsible for the public fisc and to make sure that the government's monies is being used appropriately and properly. And that's why, in a lot of instances, you know, a contracting officer is going to push back or question a contractor's requests for additional funds or what have you. And that's perfectly acceptable. There should be that little tension between the contractor and the contracting officials. But the FAR Council also tells us, Tim, in FAR Part 1, that collaboration is critical. And that's an important part of the acquisition process.
I think you have a winner, Steve.
All right.
Yes, we have our first individual who raised their hand is Don Feltz. If Don wants to unmute themselves briefly.
Can you hear me?
We hear you great, Don. Welcome.
Thank you. We said she. My team said she.
Your team is absolutely correct.
There we go.
The Part G of a solicitation will have the name of the contracting officer. And it also will have the name of the contracting officer's representative to the extent the contracting officer has delegated certain contractual authority to that individual. And more often than not, the responsibility of the core, the COR, or if you really want to find out how long someone's been practicing government contracts, Tim referred to someone known as a COTAR because it used to be the contracting officer's technical representative. And that particular abbreviation or terminology was changed because a lot of cores are doing more work than just technical acceptance or rejection. But more often than not, the core is delegated authority by the contracting officer to accept or reject deliverables. They also might be granted authority to accept or reject requests for travel. They may be given opportunities to accept or reject a request for other purposes for making payment within the scope of the contract. But the important thing is more often than not, and it should, that delegation will be placed into the contract, so you'll know who has authority to accept or reject those certain items.
Well, if you ever have any doubt about it, always send it to the CO, the contracting officer. And I should say, Steve, there are agencies like the Tank and Automotive Command that the Army has in Warren, Michigan, outside Detroit, where the procurement contracting officer, a PCO, might have 90 to 100 ACOs, administrative contracting officers, working under them. These are major commands. And it is possible that you'll rarely engage directly with the actual CO. But Steve and I will tell you in almost every episode that you have of Fun with the FAR that unless you get something in front of the CO, there's a good chance it isn't official, right? So you always write to the CO on major issues.
Exactly. And Tim and I have actually interacted on a separate PCI program talking about communications with the federal government in a federal.
I lost Steve.
Yeah, looks like we lost him briefly. May need to reconnect, but if you wanted to pick up where he left off, Tim.
Okay. Steve and I, when we teach our effective communications program, we make sure that anything that is above administrative, actually, is always copied to the contracting officer. You have to do that because I've lost count of the number of cases that I have read in the books that lawyers use, the decisions I've read, where a contractor acting in good faith got burned because they followed the directions of someone on the government side that wasn't the contracting officer, and therefore the boards and the courts simply refused to let that the contractor get paid for what they did and what the government got. Now, sometimes there are ways around it, but usually the government and the courts and the boards draw a very hard line. If you don't get the contracting officer's written approval of something, it didn't happen. And it is a brutal rule of government contracting. In fact, there is a Supreme Court decision from 1948 that basically stands for the proposition that the risk of dealing with an unauthorized government official is on the contractor. And therefore, before you agree to anything material, make sure that the person you're dealing with on the other side has the authority to bind the government. For example, if I'm a contracting officer whose warrant is $2 million and we reach an agreement and shake hands on a deal that's 2.5, it's void. It's not a deal because that CO didn't have the warrant to make the deal. And so it's not improper. It's not out of line for a contractor to ask someone and just blame the lawyer. Say, our lawyers tell us we need to see a copy of your warrant. Oh, sure, I'll get that to you, right? But in the effective communications program we run, anything that's above the administrative level, you want to make sure you're at least copying the contracting officer, usually writing to them directly. The assumption that because the contracting officer and the COR are on the same side of the table at the mm-hmm. same agency doesn't mean they know exactly, they all know the same stuff. Usually the CO is the last to learn about these things because, as Steve will tell you, some CORs believe it is their mission in life to end run the CO whenever they can. And that is why we place the emphasis and the pressure on the contractor to notify the contracting officer, to put them on notice of any material issues that arise during government contract performance. Steve, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. And Tim, I think the other thing I want to bring up with regard to members of the acquisition team on the government side is that end user customer, the customer who has asked the procurement office to purchase a particular service or supply, because ultimately that is your procurement office's customer. More often than not, they have helped draft the statement of work. They've helped draft the specifications or the statement of need as to what they want to accomplish. But one of the things that we need to understand, again, is although the end user customer is important, once that contract has been written and signed, that end user customer does not have the authority to change it. Although what often will happen is something will be provided. The end user customer will say, this is not what I wanted. This is not what I can use. This is what I need. Somebody needs to fix this. And one of the things that, Tim, you and I have often said is often the contractor is afraid to say no.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They want to please the customer. They understand relationships are important. But again, in that instance, it's important that when the end user customer might approach the contractor and say, hey, Ken, I need something different. I think the proper response would be, okay, let's talk to the CO and see whether there's might be sufficient funding to add that particular level of service or that particular make or model. But it could impact your contract. So you need to make sure, again, it's important that the contractor keep the CO in a loop because, again, authority. With regard to the contractor, the chief player that should be identified to the government is whoever is responsible within the contractor's organization for receiving requests from the government, receiving notifications from the government. That single point of contact is critical. I will also make to that point, more often than not, it will be that contractor, the person within the contracts organization who's been identified, who's responsible for the day-to-day administration of the contract. It's important. And again, this is a little tip or trick for contractors. To the extent that point of contact might be going on vacation or might be going on some form of leave, it is important that any communication get forwarded to someone else within that contractor's contracting organization so things don't miss or fall through the cracks.
Yeah, Steve, as you and I know, the number one statute that applies to all government contract situations is Murphy's Law, right? Something can go wrong at will. And when you're on the beach for 2 weeks, you can't just think that you can leave everything alone and come back in 2 weeks and catch up. You'd be shocked at what can happen. You might get the notice of an award of your major contract to your competitor, and it's in your inbox, right? And you're on the beach at Hilton Head and don't get it for 2 weeks. Guess what? You're out of luck, probably.
Right.
Challenge that thing. So, yeah, you've got to have backup.
All right, Tim, we're going to jump in.
I lost Steve again. So, Patrick, I should pick up, I think, from here.
Yes, that sounds good to me.
All right. So this isn't the last time you're going to hear Steve and his guests talk about the importance of dealing with the contracting officer on material terms. You'll hear about it many times throughout Fun with the FAR. But it is amazing, having said that, how many, even of the most experienced contractors, get burned on this fundamental principle of making sure you notify the contracting officer when important things have happened or are about to happen in the performance of a contract. And I'll just say one more thing about that. I was a contracting officer at the CIA, and so I had contracts being performed all over the world. So your contracting officers and your performance team, the COR, they aren't necessarily in offices side by side, right? Again, some CORs are better than others about working in tandem with contracting officers. So the contractor has to protect itself by making sure that anything important comes to the contracting officer's attention. That is major for you. Okay, so let's move on to the things that we want to. Are you back, Steve?
I'm back, Tim. Let's go to the FAR, the FAR conventions.
Okay.
Okay. That show up, in FAR Part 1. Okay. Cause those are important with regard, and they will be applicable throughout the rest of our journey through the FAR when we're looking through the various parts and subparts and sections and subsections of the FAR. Okay. And those particular conventions, they show up at 1.108. And when we take a look at what the FAR Council has told us that we, as members of the acquisition team, need to understand, to properly interpret and properly administer a federal government contract, right? They talk to us about a few things. The first is words and terms. And Tim, you and I are lawyers. To lawyers, words are important. And the same thing for contracts professionals. Words are important and how they're defined and how they should be interpreted. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we have our discussion about FAR Part 2. The second significant convention is what's called delegation of authority. And we've already talked about that. And in FAR Part 1, Tim, the FAR Council makes clear that delegation of authority should be pushed down to the lowest person in the government chain of command. And what they mean by that is the chief procurement officer is not going to be responsible for all contracting actions. That's going to be pushed down. To the extent that a contracting officer is working with a contracting specialist, those contracting actions that don't refer to either awarding, changing, or terminating a contract, a lot of those contracting actions can be pushed down as well. Dollar thresholds are very important because one of the things that we're going to discuss and learn throughout the next 52 weeks is that certain contracts clauses or certain procurement statutes are effective only to the extent a contract is at a certain dollar threshold. And when the FAR Council says a contract's dollar threshold, one of the mistakes that's often made by the novice is they look at the award value, Tim. And the FAR Council says, don't do that. The FAR Council in FAR Part 1 specifically says, look at the award value and the value of any available option.
Right.
So to use as an example, if your contract has a base award value of $1 million, but has four option years that each are valued at $1 million, the dollar threshold for that particular procurement or that particular contract would be $5 million. What often comes into question, Tim, is when there is an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract.
IDIQ.
Also referred to as IDIQs. And those are...
Yeah, those are, I think Steve got lost again. Those are very common in government contracting. And we talk about these different thresholds. I was actually going to talk to you about the simplified acquisition threshold. In other words, the government can use the simplified acquisition procedures for any procurement under $250,000. We have those thresholds. So you'll see thresholds throughout your government contracting world. Let's say you got a sole source contract awarded to your company to manufacture some kind of a weapon system for them, and it's $30 million. Well, because it's over the $2 million Truth in Negotiations Act threshold, you'll be subject to providing the contracting officer with what we call certified cost or pricing data. So there are triggers throughout the FAR, and those triggers are usually dollar thresholds. And again, you'll become more familiar with them depending on the type of business your company does with the government or the type of buying you're doing for the government. What happens when the FAR changes and you all of a sudden wonder to yourself, well, does it apply to our contract? Once a contract is awarded, the terms of that contract remain unchanged for the life of the contract. Even if some of the clauses and things that are in that contract might change because the FAR Council has adopted these changes, your contract is sacrosanct. It will not be changed. The solicitations could be modified, but generally, once the contract is awarded, that's it for you. I remember I had a case against the Navy in the mid-80s. Again, I'm showing my age, but they were challenging my client's claim to own all the technical data rights to its the drawings it had provided the Navy, and it was 1984, and the Navy cited the current DOD FAR supplement. And we had to go back to the Navy and say, sorry, the regulations that apply to these were those in effect in 1968 when the contract was awarded. And those are the regulations you have to do if you have to follow if you're going after these. So once that contract is awarded, the terms and conditions that are in that contract remain throughout the course of that contract. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks, Tim. I apologize to you all. For some reason, there's some serious internet issues here at my home office.
That happens when you use the FAA's computer system, Steve, I think.
Yeah. So, Tim, I'm presuming we're talking about FAR changes to the FAR.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we got to the part with regard to the extent that a contract has been entered and a new regulation has arrived. and has been promulgated by the FAR Council.
Yeah.
And the agency might want to add that new regulation to the contract that's already been signed. The FAR Council and contract law makes very clearly, states very clearly that the government can add a new government contract clause or incorporate a new regulation to your contract only if the government provides the contractor what's called consideration. And often consideration is the government saying, I'm going to increase funding. You might have bid $500,000, but you know, I'll add another $50,000 if you accept this clause. That would be consideration. But more often than not, the government will be in a position. And again, this is in a contract that has options. It has an option period. The government can tell the contractor, I'm going to include this new contract clause. And the consideration for that is I will exercise the option to allow you to continue under the contract. And in that situation, the contractor has the ability to do one of two things. Say, thank you, no. And then the contract will lapse at the end of that year. At the end of the base year, the option will not be exercised. Or the contractor can say, okay, we'll accept that new clause with the understanding that you will now exercise the option so I can continue to perform and, more importantly, continue to be paid for performance. And that would be sufficient consideration to add a new contract clause to your contract. Tim, anything else?
No, yeah, I think you've covered it. The government doesn't do this a lot, though, do they, Steve? They generally, if we have new clauses and regulations coming online, they generally add them to new solicitations and new contracts that are coming out, but they don't go back to the ones that are already in the barn with the door closed and start modifying them to update them, if you will.
Tim, I will respectfully disagree, which we love to do. Because I often will see in multiple year contracts, and more specifically, and we're going to talk about this in our discussion in FAR Part 8, in a GSA schedule, multiple award schedule contract, where the government will, at the end of that 5-year period, there's a whole host of new regulations that have come into play, and a whole new host of contract clauses that come into play that they want to add to the contract.
Oh yeah.
And in that instance, the government's going to say, our agreement to exercise an option for another 5 years requires you to accept these new contract clauses.
Oh yeah.
So it does happen.
I view that as totally different from a contractor producing munitions, let's say, with a 2-year base period and 3 1-year options. They're unlikely to do it in that situation. With your federal supply schedule contract, sure, I would agree with that.
Now, Tim, again, I'm going to show my vintage, right? The best example of that, if you remember, is when the government had a specific clause they wanted to incorporate in any IT contract that dealt with year 2000. It was known as the Y2K clause.
Yeah. Right.
And they were contracting officers were directed to include that in any active contract.
Yep.
And there was a lot of back and forth as to what would be sufficient consideration or not between the contractors and the government. So it does happen, again, not often, but the government has the ability to do it, but they need to understand that they have to give something back to the contractor.
Right.
All right, let's move into the other FAR conventions, citations. The government might have a specific FAR citation or particular statute citation in your contract. That if they do that, the understanding is the entire contract, the entire statute or the entire regulation or the entire contract clause will be incorporated by reference into your contract. And
okay, we lost Steve again. Yeah. So the question, when something's incorporated by reference, and this is a little trick you need to, in terms of tricks and tips that Steve would give you. Sometimes an agency like the Naval Supply Center Norfolk, right? It will incorporate by reference its local procurement rules or clauses. And that means they're part of the contract. Even though they're not laid out in your contract, they have been incorporated by reference. And so before you accept those things, our recommendation would always be you want to read them first, because these local rules often are the screwiest things you've ever seen. They haven't gone through the real rulemaking process. And yet agencies or buying activities will incorporate them by reference. Now, I know the human nature is we don't even look at this stuff. We assume it's all boilerplate and it's harmless. Wrong. So I'm glad Steve's outline talks about these things. So when something is incorporated by reference, it's there in your contract as if it were written out in full. Now, when we talk about the language you encounter in the FAR, and we'll spend a lot of time on this in the course of a day as a government contractor, whether something is imperative. If the FAR uses the word shall, that's an imperative. So shall is what Steve and I would call almost a term of art. And it's different from may. When a contracting officer may do something, well, they don't have to.
Or Jim, I'll also add the word should.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say should. So you beat me to the punch, but you're back. Good. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There might be some instances in the FAR where it says the contractor or the government should do something.
Right.
They're not required to do it, but the FAR Council is saying it's probably a good idea. It's a best practice, but it's not imperative. And that's one of the things we understand. The FAR Council also says to the extent that there is a shall in a FAR regulation, because it often says the government shall do something, the implication is that responsibility belongs to the contracting officer unless it can be delegated through the authority matrix. The last thing that the FAR convention is this whole concept of prescriptive language. One of the things that we're going to discuss, and you'll notice through our journey, is at the end of many of these FAR parts, there is a section, or also could be included somewhere in the middle as well. There will be sections that say, here are the particular contract clauses that should be incorporated into a contract given certain circumstances existing. And that is known as a prescriptive FAR clause, that it's telling the contracting officer, if this circumstance exists, and it's going to be in FAR parts 1 through 51, that you should be adding certain contract clauses that are set forth in total in FAR part 52.
Well, the prescriptions, Steve, really are all in FAR Part 52. I mean, what it says is if you go to any clause in FAR Part 52, it tells you where the prescription is. As prescribed in FAR 31.101, the contract. But so that's the relationship. I mean, and I found this most difficult, actually, at the subcontracting level when the prime would try and throw everything into the subcontract. And we'd say, wait a second, it doesn't apply here. And then to win that argument, we'd go to the prescriptions, the FAR Part 52, to show that clause and how it would only apply, for example, to cost reimbursement contracts. So that was a big deal for us.
And Tim, if we could do our second password of the day.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so we'll do our second password now. Just a reminder again, you really want to write these down if you are seeking any sort of credit. Our second password of the day is moonlighting. One word, MOON. LIGHTING, moonlighting. All right.
Thank you, Patrick, and I'll take over. I think we've lost Steve again. So so let's move into what we call here agency acquisition regulations, but the informal way we describe these are supplemental regulations. What happened before the FAR came into being in 1984, there were two basic sets of regulations. There was the defense acquisition regulation, the DAR, and there was the federal procurement regulation, the FPR. So if you were doing business with the Navy, or the Air Force or the Marines or the Army, you were covered by the DAR because they were defense agencies. If you were doing business with, let's say, the Department of Commerce or the Department of Transportation, you were covered by the Federal Procurement Regulation. Well, pity those poor companies that were doing business with both DOD and non-DOD agencies, because they had to work with both regulations. Now, there were similarities, but they weren't identical, for sure. So some people in the 70s said, this is ridiculous. We're one U.S. dollar being spent. Let's put it under one regulation. And then in 1978, the statute was passed to do this, and they began working on the FAR. Well, as Steve will tell you more than once in our business, in our time together over the next 52 weeks, in the world of government contracting, the elephant in the room is the Defense Department.
Right.
And the Defense Department's view of this whole thing was, well, wait a second. You're telling me we're going to be governed by the same people who buy paper and pencil? And we're buying rocket ships and we're buying attack warplanes? And, I mean, come on. We got to have our own set of regulations. And so the law provided that major procurement commands, agencies, could issue a supplemental regulation to the FAR. It was supposed to supplement it and not contradict it, although Steve will get into that. And so in 1984, when the FAR came into being, within hours, the DOD FAR supplement came into being. It was almost as big as the FAR. And here we are today, Steve, and I'll let you take it from there.
Right. You're absolutely right, Tim. The bottom line is the FAR Council makes clear that these agent supplemental regulations shouldn't repeat, paraphrase, restate, or more importantly, be in conflict with the FAR.
Right.
The one exception to that, Tim, is the Department of Defense's data rights provisions.
Data rights, yeah.
Okay. And the reason for that is statutory. The federal government specifically provided authority to the Department of Defense to be in conflict with some of the language in FAR Part 27. And we're going to get into more details about that later on in our journey. So there's some differences, but the bottom line is these agencies should not be in conflict with the language that are set forth in the FAR. And we have a separate PCI class called Defund with the DFARS that goes in more depth here. We're not going to be talking a lot about these agency supplemental regulations, but occasionally there might be a situation where we need to, like in our discussion about FAR Part 27. And also the FAR Council often will tell commercial buyers that there might be some certain circumstances where these other DOD regulations or how DOD buys more particularly needs to be understood in a particular procurement. Let's now jump into deviations, Tim, because I think that's important. The federal government has developed a process wherein the specific language in the FAR can be changed and incorporated into a contract through what's known as the deviation process. And more often than not, Tim, the reason for a deviation to be required is because a statute has changed.
Right.
Or because another regulation that might be applicable has changed. The classic case that often comes up is when the cost accounting standards dollar threshold changed. Old references in the FAR, there needed to be a deviation to that. There are also situations recently with regard to some of the COVID regulations that came into play with regard to how the contractor workforce needed to be vaccinated. There were multiple deviations that were released by each individual agency to say, hey, we're going to incorporate this by reference. The important thing, again, is deviations will often be denoted in your contract and should be to the extent the government is changing language in the FAR, you're going to see in parentheticals you're going to have the FAR citation to Part 52, and in a parenthetical, it will say deviation. It's very important as a contractor, to the extent the government is just giving you a FAR citation with a.
Well, we just lost Steve again. All right, so the deviation will be listed, and this is something that the agency has gone through, has requested and obtained a deviation from someone called the OFPP, the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Now, where do they sit in the government? Well, in the executive branch, you have the White House, and you have something called the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, right, the OMB. And they play a major role in the whole government budgeting process that takes place on an annual basis, as you know, because the Congress appropriates funds annually. And OMB, beneath OMB, we have the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Their job is to basically dictate federal government procurement policy. Now, they do that working with all the agencies. And as you can imagine, DOD is the biggest elephant in the room there. But that's how it works. And the deviation process works through them. It's explained again in the FAR, FAR 1.4. It's not something you'd have to worry about on a frequent basis, to be honest with you. But the regulations are written so that agencies, when necessary, can obtain deviations from those regulations. So that moves us into the role of the contracting officer. And FAR makes it pretty clear the CO is the key person in the award and performance of any federal government contract. And they will be assisted by the COR, as we talked about a little bit later. See, Steve, you're back.
I'm back again.
Okay.
All right. So I think, and I can't tell if anybody has any questions with regard to deviations. Again, please, you know, to some extent, you can raise your hand and let us know. But if not, let's move into ratification, Tim, because that's also important discussion in part one.
Right.
And ratification pops up in 1.602-3. And the interesting thing is, Tim, I'm not sure in your discussion in FAR Part 1, we've had a conversation before about the importance of where FAR Part 1 is in the FAR. It's the very first section that kind of establishes the skeleton to some extent, the framework for the rest of the FAR. Ratification, interestingly enough, this is a trivia for all of you out there, shows up in two places in the FAR. One is in FAR Part 1. And the other time it shows up is in FAR Part 51. And ratification is used in very rare situations. And to some extent, the FAR Council identifies it as extraordinary relief. And it's a situation where a contractor relies upon statements or directions from someone within the federal government that doesn't have authority. Now, Tim, that kind of runs counter to what we just talked about earlier in the show, which is if the contractor relies on someone with authority, they're out of luck. How does ratification play?
Steve, when you were offline out in cyberspace, I pointed out that in 1948, the Supreme Court issued an opinion that basically sent the message that the risk of dealing with an unauthorized government employee is on the contractor. And yet, as I said to the class when you were offline, even the most experienced, the names that are household names as government contractors, have problems dealing with the ramifications of their employees following the directions of an unauthorized government person. A general, a COR, a lawyer, an inspector who can be bullies, and now you're telling them, telling the contractor what – so the contractor does it. So now they're – hundreds of thousands or $1 million in the hole, how do they get paid for it? And they go to the contracting officer with a request for equitable adjustment or a written claim and say, hey, we need $1 million. And the CEO says, I didn't tell you to do this. I never signed it. Pound sand. And then they ask the contracting officer to ratify the unauthorized actions of someone else in that agency. And as I've always said to my clients and my students, ratification is a four-letter word in government contracting parlance because The last thing the chief of contracts wants to do in an agency is send a message out to the contracting community that COs are there to clean up their COR's messes. Right, Steve?
Right, so absolutely.
I'll turn it back to you.
Well, I think the important thing is with regard to ratifications, because this is also often come up in conversations, Tim, when I'm doing training within a contract organization, including the organizations that I worked within. Sure. And I didn't get an opportunity to introduce what my background is for many of you. But you know, I've been in this business since 1988. I've worked for, the Department of Defense. I've worked for, a major federal government contracting, legal practice. I've worked for a mid-sized IT firm. I've worked for one of the largest big four accounting firms. And the last company I worked for was a satellite communications contract. Contractor who did work with the Department of Defense. The people often say, well, if I do something with on the direction of someone who doesn't have authority, I can still get paid, right, Steve? And I always had to say, time out. We need to understand that the contracting officer is going to have to go to a higher authority to get that ratification approved. And the contracting officer, more often than not, is also going to have to go to their lawyers to get that ratification approved. And it is not easy for a contracting officer to want to do that. Because what happens often is, well, someone's going to say, well, why didn't you know? Why weren't your people in line with regard to asking for this work or acting in a direction they shouldn't have? They're going to have to justify as to why the additional money should be paid by the government. And the FAR clause states very, very carefully. The part in 1.602-3, that there are multiple things that the contracting officer is going to have to put into that document to make this request. And at times they're not easy to prove. The ratifying official has authority to enter into a contractual agreement. The resulting contract would otherwise have been proper if made by the contracting officer. The contracting officer reviewing the unauthorized commitment determines the price is fair and reasonable. The contracting officer recommends payment and legal counsel concurs in the recommendation. Funds are available. If funds are not available or if the agency has to go somewhere else to get that funding, that often is not very easy. And ultimately, the ratification has to be in accordance with some other limitation or any other limitation prescribed under the agency procedure. So there has to be a legal framework. There has to be a financial framework. And often someone has to pay some political capital, Tim.
Oh, big time.
To get that ratification through.
Big time. It is, they do not want to send the message to the contracting community that the CO is there to clean their messes up that unauthorized employees have made. And I can assure you that contractors who've been burned on these things, the next time someone who's other than a CO says, can you do this or can you do that? They've learned their lesson and they say, if the CO tells us in writing, we're happy to comply. Right?
Right.
I mean, and that's sort of what's going on here. They want to get the contracting community to play by the rules. And this is a tough lesson to learn as a contractor.
Or Tim, what often happens is a contractor is going to do a CO and say, oh, come on, you did it before.
Yeah.
Why can't you do it again?
Yeah.
Right.
That's about the worst thing you could ever say. You're not getting a penny if that happens.
Right.
I mean, this is a way of reminding everybody that only a CO can make changes to the contract. This is the number one lesson is the ratification process.
Okay. Tim, let's talk about. There's a question. Determinations and findings.
I think you might have a question.
Oh, good.
Hi. Yes, my name is Catherine Hill. Nice to be here with everybody today. I actually don't have a question, but I just wanted to flag that other people have questions and have had questions. Like, hands have gone up a few times. It's not clear to me that you all as presenters are able to see the hands raised. So I just wanted to flag it. I'm not sure if
John is online and
can monitor it.
Thank you. I think Patrick can tell us what those questions are, right, Patrick?
Yes. So we can, there are no hands up right now except for Dawn, but I presume that was from when she had answered that original question. I don't see any hands now, but I will let you guys know for sure in the future if there are hands up.
Well, why don't we go quiet for a minute and just let people ask questions if they want to right now?
Yes, absolutely. If anyone has a question, go ahead and raise your hand.
Hey there.
We've gone through a lot of material.
Okay.
All right, Daniel.
Well, someone's
question goes back to... All right, can you hear me?
We hear you great, Daniel. Thank you.
Okay. This question goes back to the consideration discussion, and you were talking about the option year being exercised. So the typically exercise of an option is a unilateral modification that we really can't not accept. So are you saying that that is the consideration that the KO could give us the opportunity to not accept an option period and continue with those new regs in place?
No, I think the consideration would be that the KO is telling you up front, we will exercise that option. Because the government has the ability up until that option period date to decide whether they're going to or not, but only to the extent but you're going to remember there's always a notice requirement. There's normally a 90-day to 120-day notice where the government's going to say, we reserve the right to exercise that option. And in this situation, the government's going to say, no, we will exercise the option. So that next year, performance will continue.
Wait a second, Steve. I think what Daniel's saying is, what if they say, but on this option, we're adding this new requirement that Congress has just enacted or the clause. I don't think they can do that unilaterally without the contractor agreeing to it.
No, you got to remember, because I said the contractor has two, in that situation, the contractor has two options. They can either say, yes, we're willing to accept and move on for another year, or no, we don't accept and we agree to the contract will lapse.
And that's Daniel's question, because what Daniel's point was, otherwise the government's right to exercise an option is unilateral. It would basically be bilateral in this
absolutely.
Situation. Okay.
Yep, in that situation, that's one of the situations where that unilateral ability to exercise the option goes away. Because again, the FAR Council makes very clear there has to be consideration. So there has to be the agreement of the contractor to go forward. But that's a great question. Anybody else? I'm enjoying this hearing my participants. And we haven't done this in the prior 9 years here.
I think Dawn.
I think Dawn does actually have a question. So I apologize, Dawn, for dismissing you there.
Apparently, it just
that
dawned on
right. This actually is someone with my team. They have a question going back a little bit.
Okay, that's fine.
This is Anthony Atkins, and I had a question. Tim had said once the it's awarded that the regulations at the time were in effect. He gave an example back in 1968 that. They challenged it, and then he went back and said the effect in 1968, the regulations in place at that time were effective. However, what if they would have came back and said, well, we're exercising the right of the Christian doctrine, so what do you do in that respect?
Wouldn't work.
Tim, why don't you first explain what the Christian doctrine is to the group, because many might not be familiar with it.
All right, and thank you, Anthony, for that question. The Christian doctrine has nothing to do with religion. It's a case from 1963 from the United States Court of Claims where the contractor had a Navy contract and the Navy came along and said, well, we're going to terminate for convenience. And the contractor's lawyer said, well, you can't actually because you forgot to put the termination for convenience clause in our contract. And the Navy said, hold that thought. We'll get right back to you. So a couple of months later, they came back and said, well, our lawyers say – technically, you're right. Now, when someone on the other side says you're technically right, you know you got them, right? So they say, technically, you're right. The clause wasn't in there, but it should have been in there. So we're going to act as if it had been there all along. And Christian said, well, you're not getting away with that. So they sued him for breach of contract in the Court of Claims. And Oscar Davis, one of the best judges who ever served there, wrote an opinion in 63 saying, well, we agree with the Navy. If a clause represents fundamental federal procurement policy, if it's a mandatory clause, we will read it into a government contract, even if the government forgot to put it in. Okay, so that's the Christian doctrine. It's been applied to a handful of other clauses. It's vastly abused at the subcontracting level, but Steve will get into that at some other point.
We will.
But to go to Anthony's point, in my view, Anthony, they could make the Christian doctrine argument, but no competent judge would accept it because those new data rights regulations were not something that the government forgot to put in 68. They weren't even around. So it doesn't apply in that case. But I've always viewed that as a very good example of how the contract you are awarded, as it's written on the day of award, will by and large always be the contract that you have to resolve problems around. I mean, so new regulations don't come into play. Something that happened between 68 and 84 doesn't come into play.
Right. Hey, Tim, here's a quick question for you. Let's assume that contract was let in 1968.
It was.
And a statute or a particular contract clause wasn't included in the contract. It's mandatory under the FAR at the time of award. It benefits the contract. In that situation, that contract clause would be read into the contract, even if performance is already 5 years or 4 years in.
Probably. Yeah. But that's a different situation.
Absolutely. But I just wanted to make that clear that the government could enforce a contract clause 4 years later that the contractor scratch their head and go, where is it? They're going to say, no, it's been read into the contract. Now, I will be remiss, Tim, because we normally don't get to the Christian doctrine this early, and I'll thank our participant for bringing this up now. I'm a firm believer that there is no reverse Christian doctrine, that a contract clause in your contract is going to be read out because the contractor thinks, well, it wasn't applicable. There is no reverse Christian doctrine. To the extent a contractor believes a contract clause that's been offered to you or appears in your contract before you sign it, you feel it's not applicable or it doesn't make sense, you need to challenge that before you sign it. More often than not, it might be in the solicitation stage. We're going to talk about how you can do that in our discussion in FAR Part 14 and FAR Part 15. Or this has happened to him. I've seen this. Contract clauses often might pop up. They were never in the solicitation, and all of a sudden they show up in the contract document because things are moving fast and what have you, that never appeared. It's incumbent upon the contractor to scrub that contract before they sign it.
Yeah, the assumption that when you were offline in cyberspace, I made the point, Steve, that that so many people don't bother to look at these things in depth because they view it all as boilerplate and it's been there before. I don't have to look at it. But I especially told them the trouble that's caused by local procurement regulations, right, or clauses, which haven't gone through the rulemaking process, and there can be some doozies in there. And if you've accepted a clause like that that's been incorporated by reference, you've got a problem.
Right.
You've got a problem. But Anthony's question was excellent. Right. I think we have some others.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't see any other hands raised, so I think we're good on questions.
Okay, good. Tim, let's jump into 1.7, which is determinations and findings. Often referred in the abbreviations D's and F's.
D and F.
There are certain contracting actions that a contracting officer might take during either the solicitation phase or the market research phase or the contract performance stage that requires them to make a determination that has to be supported by facts. The determination basically is a final decision. The findings are the facts that support it. The example that I normally will use, Tim, is, and we're going to talk about this in another, in more detail, in further on in our journey, is when the government decides to issue a contract on a time and materials basis. And the, in FAR Part 16, the contracting officer is told that you must do, or must find certain facts before you can utilize a time and materials contract. I will also, Tim, now that I think about it, ratification more often than not is going to be supported by a determination and finding. And the findings or facts are those items, that must be found before a contracting officer, in fact, can ratify, an unauthorized commitment of government funds.
Well, another one, Steve, that I think is much more, used to be a lot more common than it is today is, before a contracting officer can issue a solicitation on a sole source basis, the CO has to issue a CNF, a DNF, supporting that decision.
Correct. Or that's a justification and approval, Tim, for sole source.
A JNA.
A JNA, which is a little bit different. And we're going to talk about that when we get into that discussion about full and open competition.
That's a good point. Yep.
Are there any questions? Any questions at all with regard to FAR Part 1 before we move into FAR Part 2?
And I should say, Steve, that when you were offline, I made the point that our business is laden with acronyms, and we've just hammered them with DNF and JNA. We talked about TINA. We've talked about COs and CORs. And so welcome to government contracting.
It's true. And one of the things, Patrick, I believe – that we have provided to all our participants is what we call our Public Contracting Institute abbreviations matrix. That to some extent, to the extent you want to print it out and have it with you on future episodes, please do that. We also have included, Tim, I'm not sure if you know, to all of our participants, all the circumstances where a determination in finding might be required to take a contracting action. That's also in that group of documents that we have in our Fun with the FAR portal.
Yes, that should be in the links document that was in the email for everyone wondering.
Exactly. So, Tim, let's jump into FAR Part 2, which the FAR Council identifies as definitions, words, and terms. And I think the important thing, we've already talked about the FAR Convention with regards to words, and terms are important. They are the FAR Council makes very clear that the definitions, and there's a whole host of definitions in FAR Part 2.101. And there is a contract clause, a FAR contract clause. It's FAR 52.202-1 that more often than not will appear in every single government contract that you either will issue as a government contracts official or as a that you will sign as a contractor official. All of these definitions in FAR 2.101 will be incorporated by reference into your contract if that particular FAR part clause is included. The FAR Council will also tell us, though, Tim, interestingly enough, that you can ignore these definitions if there's some other definition in a FAR part that follows. So the 2.101 definitions, although will often supersede and be important, it's also important to note if a word is defined elsewhere.
Well, sometimes, Steve, there are, like I'm thinking in FAR Part 15, they define the word discussion. They define the word clarification. They aren't even in FAR Part 2. And so the way I've always taught this is if you in a particular FAR part, when it has its own definitions, that applies only to that part.
Yes.
The definitions in FAR Part 2 apply to the entire FAR, all throughout the FAR, unless a FAR Part kind of overrides it, right? Wouldn't that override part two if the same term is defined in a particular part and in part two?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Now, here's the other interesting fact. A contracting officer, Tim, has the authority to define a word. That's completely different than that set forth in 2.101. But that definition needs to be included in total by into the contract.
Well, wouldn't it have to be in the solicitation, though?
Of course.
It would have to be in the solicitation. Because,
absolutely.
It is. The CO couldn't give you a new definition in the contract if they didn't give you notice of that in the solicitation.
Yep. Again, 52.202-1 tells contractors, okay? And I very rarely will spend time reading verbatim what the FAR says, but I want to do that here. It says when a solicitation provision in an RFP, an IFB, an RFQ, or contract clause uses a word or term that is defined in the Federal Acquisition Regulation, the word or term has the same meaning as the definition in FAR 2.101. Unless the solicitation or amended solicitation provides a different definition, to your point, Tim, or the contracting parties agree to a different definition, which I would also state, Tim, you probably would rather have that in a contract that's signed as opposed to later.
Right.
After contract award, or the part, subpart, or section of the FAR where the provision or clause is prescribed provides a different meaning. We talked about that. If FAR Part 27 has a different definition, for example, of data,
right,
then in FAR Part 2.101, FAR Part 27 would prevail. In defining what the word is in that particular FAR clause, 52, the FAR Part 52 contract clause that's prescribed by FAR Part 27. And then the last is, or the word or term is defined in FAR Part 31 for use in the cost principles or procedures. Or lastly, the word or term defines an acquisition related threshold. And if the threshold is adjusted for inflation as set forth in FAR Point 1.109A, then the change threshold applies throughout the remaining term of the contract. And that's to take into account, Tim, a lot of those TINA and CAS issues with regard to applicability.
Yeah, but Steve, you've just by reading that, let me say this to the class. One of the worst things you could ever do to somebody that's probably something that would violate the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, is to ask them to sit down and read the FAR and then let's talk, right? But if I come to you one day and say, oh my gosh, this contracting office, we submitted our bid electronically at 2 o'clock, Baghdad time, and it got to the CO's desk, after 3 o'clock when they were supposed to get it. What do I do? Now I've got a set of facts. And if I go to the FAR and I go to, the language in FAR Part 52 to the clause that talks about how to deal with late proposals, And what except now I've got a set of facts. And when I read it, the language comes screaming at me, right? It'll jump right off the page at you. So the FAR is, it's like a chameleon. The way you read a clause can be shaded differently. It can be colored differently based on your facts. So you'll find that if it's very strange to you now and what Steve has been sharing with you sounds so foreign, once you put facts up against it on any little case, then the FAR is going to really come alive for you.
Absolutely. Tim, before we end, I want to spend a little and spot on, Tim, with regard to if a word is ambiguous, right, or what should a contractor do if they receive a solicitation and there's some ambiguity?
Well, first of all, the first thing you do is there's a clause in your solicitation called order of precedence. And it will tell you what parts of the solicitation are, how they relate to each other and which is more important. And you might be able to resolve the same word could be used twice and it looks different in that solicitation, it'll tell you which one to give precedence. If it doesn't, then you need to go to the contracting officer and ask them to resolve what you believe is an ambiguous term. But you've got to do it before proposals are submitted. And I don't mean that you have until 1:59 and 30 seconds if that proposal is due at 2 o'clock. Get there as early as you can to resolve these things and let them tell you what they believe it means.
Right. And the danger and the reason for that, Tim, right, is if a finder of fact later, if there's a dispute revolving around that ambiguity, later determines that that ambiguity was patent, meaning it wasn't hidden, and the contractor did not raise the issue, there might be an issue with regard to the drafter. Drafter's interpretation would, to some extent, could possibly be accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. On the other hand, the rule of contra profferentum in contract interpretation, Steve, tells us that it usually will be charged against the drafter of the language. The problem is, under the proper approach to contract interpretation, you don't get to that little rule until step number 10.
Right.
And so for the folks on the line, if you're new to this business, one of the most fascinating aspects of government contracting, this is a lawyer talking, is the problems caused by contract interpretation, where the drafter believes they know what they mean when they write it down, but the reader doesn't read it the same way, right? The drafter right. says, you know, we want a 10-foot, we want a 10-foot barbed wire fence around the work site. That's the way to secure it. But all they say in the RFP and the statement of work is adequate security.
Right.
And then 10 days into the contract, your COR comes and says, where's your barbed wire fence? What do you mean? Well, it says adequate security, right? So
right.
If you don't understand a term, you got to ask about it beforehand.
That's exactly right, Tim. All right, we're getting down to the closing minutes. Any questions from you all with regard to FAR Part 2? Raise your hand if you've got a question. Okay, seeing none. I first and foremost, again, want to apologize from technical difficulties on my end. I will assure you that we're going to work through those and going forward. I am thrilled that all of you are here and joining me on the next 52 weeks of what I hope will be a very informative and fun educational experience for you all. I know you've got a lot of choices. We're thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much for some of you who are repeat customers. We're thrilled about that. I'm looking forward to having Tim back possibly for another episode. I'm looking forward to all my other guests going forward. I'm hoping that next two Wednesdays from now, January 25th, we're going to be talking about FAR Part 3. Improper business practices and personal conflicts of interest. I look forward to seeing you all. Until then, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us. Oh, wait a minute. Melissa's got a question.
Oh, we got two questions.
Okay.
Go ahead, Melissa.
I was just wondering about third password.
We are just about to get to that. Good on you for remembering.
Good job, Melissa. You got him.
Look at her. She got you.
Very nice. Yeah, so that's a perfect lead-in. Thank you, Melissa, for that. Our third and final password of the day is COSTAR. It is spelled COSTAR, COSTAR.
All right, Miriam.
I'm good, thank you.
All right. Well, I'm hoping one of you get that trivia question. Zachary. Cindy.
I think they're giving the answer to the trivia
question. All right, okay. Well,
that would be Sybil Shepherd.
You're absolutely right, winner. Yes. Sybil Shepherd is correct. Except some of you have not seen that show because you might not be the same vintage as me. If you can find it, definitely watch it. I know you can probably get some of the episodes on YouTube. But thank you again for joining us. And I look forward to seeing you guys in 2 weeks.
And then John is going to do a quick closing out as well, I believe. So just a quick poll. I believe that John is still out there.
Okay, John.
Yes, everyone, thank you for joining the first session of Home with the Far. Those of you who are interested in certificates, I want to remind everyone that they'll need to log into PCI's website and answer it over in my certificates and courses. That'll all be up in the top right-hand corner. If you need help, you can email me. I'm john@publiccontractinginstitute.com. There's also a feedback poll for the first session there, so go ahead and take a look at that. It'll have the materials starting tomorrow. All the materials will be there available for everyone, and that'll be sort of your Fun with the Far Hub, apart from your email, which also serves as a Fun with the Far Hub. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you again.
Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you.